Ave, and welcome to When in Rome. And now, cue the music.
Yeah. When in Rome, do as the Romans do. Far from home, all I got is you.
When in Rome is a podcast about place and space in the Roman Empire. This is episode LXXVII, The Temple of Bel. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and joining me today is Dr. Peter Edwell, a senior lecturer in the Department of History and Archaeology at Macquarie University. The Temple of Bel in Palmyra mixed the religions of Rome with beliefs of the East, providing the residents of the city with their own unique deities. While significant as a Roman temple, it had a long history in the years that followed, and has played an important part in Syria's recent tragic events. Here's Peter Edwell.
We often think of the Temple of Bel in relation to the kella, so the actual central religious element itself, where a lot of the ceremonies and etc. took place. But the Temple of Bel is really a whole enclosure, and we're talking about a temenos that measures around 200 metres on each side, so it's very large. And in the, pretty much in the center of it is this kella, this temple structure. And it's just to the southeast of the main city area itself. The work done to rework the central street and really turn it into a colonnaded axis seems to have been so that the city would be better aligned with the Temple of Bel itself. So it shows how the Bel complex, how important it was and to the whole city.
Was it on an elevated terrain at all? Did it look down on the rest of the city? Was it in a good position that way?
Only slightly. It's on a mound. So, I mean, the kella itself is on a mound. But from the complex, you can see bits of the city. But if you think of, there's what's often referred to as a Turkish castle. It's an Islamic-era castle right up on the Jebel behind Palmyra that has this incredible view back over Palmyra. I mean, you know, if you wanted to have a view out over the city, you'd put a temple up there, and maybe there was one there in the earlier period. But the Bel complex, it's not a view down onto the city or anything like that. The relation to the city is very important, yeah.
And who was Bel, and why is the most significant temple in Palmyra dedicated to him?
Well, Bel, he's a syncretization in some ways of a southern Mesopotamian god who is Bel Marduk, and there's a syncretism between him and other Babylonian deities, for that matter, with the more localized deities at Palmyra. And it's probably as a result of trade activity. There's a merging in some ways of these traditions, these more local traditions to Palmyra and the oasis itself, and these Babylonian traditions, which were probably the most influential in the area at the time. And so we're going back here well into the pre-Roman period. When we have then the emergence of Bel and then the other Palmyrian gods in a clearer form that we then can see as a result of the sculptural and epigraphic remains. And so we're talking here about Bel, but we're talking about other gods like Baal Shemin, Ugly Bel, Malak Bel, Yahi Bel, those types of gods, yeah.
And so it's a multi-god complex to a certain extent, but Bel was like the senior one in that area?
Yeah. We get a sense of this from temples. They're much smaller, but the temples at Deuropos on the Euphrates, which is to the direct east of Palmyra. And the archaeologists are there identifying a temple of Bel or a temple to Asenath Kona as a goddess. We get evidence from those temples that there are other gods being honoured and worshipped in those temples too. And certainly that's the case at Palmyra and the Bel complex. It seems the whole pantheon of gods were recognized and honored there in various ways. But Bel is the most powerful overarching god.
Do we think it's a case of having multiple altars set up in the same structure? So you turn left, there's the altar of Bel. If you turn right, there's an altar to another deity or god.
It does seem that's the case because fortunately, one of the things that does survive are altar bases. Altar bases survive quite well. And so we often have inscriptions on them. But the thing with those sometimes too is they're often private dedications, those altar bases. So it can be tricky trying to reconstruct some of the more intricate mechanisms in terms of the way that this all worked. The other thing about the Bel complex to bear in mind is that there is a very large altar complex that sits outside. So that's just to the what we would say is would be the northwest of the Temple of Bel. And it looks like actually it would have been able to cater for large animal sacrifices. These took place outside. In fact, you can walk through it. I've walked through that particular feature. Yeah.
Yeah. And when do we think the temple was constructed, and what sort of people were building it? Was it local masonries? Were they getting in people? Do we know anything about that?
It seems to be a bit of both. We've got some local activity going on, and the stone is all being quarried locally. So that's certainly the case. We do have, you know, at Palmyra more generally, some Aswan granite columns, but I mean, they were being transported out of Egypt all over the empire. So it's not a surprise to find those, but most of the stone is local. So we've got that. We do have then Greek and Roman workmen there, and we've got that because there are survival of masons marks in individual masons, and foremen have been identified. The date in terms of the construction is an interesting one, because our thinking on that has been changing. We've had this date of 32 CE because there's an inscription actually that dates from the early 40s AD CE that refers to the dedication of the temple in 32, 10 or 11 years earlier. But what it looks like is happening with the Bell Complex is it's an ongoing construction project that may well have had its origins earlier than 32. We have the Roman Imperial Triad of Tiberius, Drusus and Germanicus being honoured in the temple in AD 18, AD 19. So we've got an honorific statue base which names them from the temple. We've got this dedicatory inscription of 32, or a reference to a dedication in 32. But the thinking now, and this is the Polish archaeologists who've worked at Palmyra for decades, is that it's an ongoing project going on through most of the first century and even into the early second century. And that wouldn't entirely surprise us, because the Bell Complex is important to place into the context of what's going on with temple construction in other cities in the area. Monumental temple construction is a real feature of the first century AD. First century BC, first century AD, and this is where we have the enormous Jupiter complex in Damascus, which now survives partly in the Umayyad Mosque. But we also have enormous temples constructed at Baalbek. And we have a lot of temple construction going on in places like Petra, so the temple to Dashares, for example, and other temples belong to this period. So it's going on through this whole area. And I think what's happening is that this is reflective of the area's growing wealth as a result of trade.
And when you look at the architecture of the temple, I gather that it's going to be a mishmash of two distinct cultural areas. So you've got the Greco-Roman style going on, but you've also got a more Eastern flavour to it as well. Yeah. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And in fact, it's in some of the sculptural detail that you see that most clearly. So you have pilasters. So these are columns that are essentially form part of the wall. They're built into the wall. They're not standing separately, but they're made to look like they're separate columns that poke out from the walls. Their capitals are Ionic. They're very clearly Ionic capitals. You then have in the Temenos columns, you have very clearly Corinthian capital heads. But on the top of the temple are these what are known as merlons, and they're often referred to as crow-stepped merlons. And these are very Babylonian. And so this is where we see some of the reconstruction that's gone on. What the French did, the merlons, there are three of them, I think, that were sitting on top of the Temple of Bel, were just reproductions. The originals had been found in bits and pieces and had been reconstructed in the temple in the Temenos. So you could go to another part of the Temenos and see them. They're very elaborate and they're very Babylonian. So you can see that the temple to the Keller, and when I'm talking about the temple, I'm mostly talking about the Keller, is very enclosed. And that's also a very Eastern type of temple, because you want to keep the heat and the dust out. Western temples tend to be more open in their structure, whereas this one is much more enclosed. So, yeah, you are definitely getting, as you might call it, a mishmash of the different cultural influences going on there in the building itself. Yeah.
And it was also a case of that you go in through the main archway, the main doorway, and then you turn to the side and the entrance was on the side. And that is something that you very much see in Eastern temples. Is that right?
That's right. In fact, the main doorway into the temple is really offset. So it's not even central on the northern wall, sits two-thirds to what would be the east. The entryway wasn't the type of entryway, again, you'd expect in a more sort of classic Greek or Roman style temple. And that, as you say, is a feature more of these eastern types of temples here.
Tell me about the reliefs that are around the place, because there were some inside the temple that were still visible. You've got roof mosaics and paintings and friezes going on that give a sense of how the space was used and thought of as well.
The sculptures that you used to see there were ones that had actually fallen down really from the areas of the pediment structure, so the top parts of the temple. And they seem to depict, you see processions. So you've got one which is in part a camel procession, and there are definitely deities associated with camels. The Palmyrenes had a god called Arsu, A-R-S-U, who was a god of the camel caravans and traders. He was a protective god, and he's associated with the night, because that's actually when the caravans were traveling at night, because it's safer
when
to
it's
travel
nice
at night.
And cool.
Yeah, cool and much safer. You're not as vulnerable. We've got something like that. We've then got depictions of the Palmyrene gods in. We've got one, for example, of Bel in a sacred grove. And so sacred groves seem to have been important in Palmyrene religion. And why wouldn't they be? Because here we've got the oasis at Palmyra, central importance. That's where the city's located. And then, of course, you have that sense of that in southern Mesopotamia as well, around those areas where you get paradises, paradisos. So the idea of a sacred grove is quite strong, it seems, in Palmyrene religion, and we see that in these types of sculptures. But they were located, the Antiquities Authority had set them up so that as you went into the doorway, you'd see these sculptures. And they were very finely crafted. There are paintings that survive, and I remember seeing them. I took photos of them, but they were so faded out. But they were paintings from the period when the Bel Keller had become a church. And unfortunately, the sun and little rain you get there had really faded them. But you could make them out, still the outlines of them, quite clearly. We presume that the interior of the Keller was plastered and painted. We would expect that. But because it became a church and was later at times used as a mosque, a lot of that earlier classical era decoration had been removed or painted over. And of course, the Keller was open to the elements as well.
Was there a painting called the Zodiac Relief?
That's actually a sculpture. Yeah, the Zodiac Relief's actually a sculpture in one solid piece of stone that sat over what's known as the North Thalamos, and an incredibly important piece. One of the things it did, it had a real impact on European design in the middle of the 18th century, when an enormous, very important architectural publication came out on Palmyra, done by an English pair called Wood and Dawkins. The designs that came out of that had quite an impact on interior design, particularly in Britain, but also in places like France. And there's a French edition of Wood and Dawkins was produced. I've actually got a copy of that too. And the Zodiac sculpture over the top of the North Thalamos is an incredibly beautifully produced, and now destroyed, of course, it was blown up. We have very detailed drawings of it. It was published extensively and photographed extensively. So, yeah.
And what did that depict?
So it depicts a zodiac. So you have very, very intricate geometric design. You're talking here a stone slab of about 5 or 6 meters by about 3 meters. And it has at least a partial zodiac. There'd been damage done to it over the years. It wasn't surviving in perfect condition, but it was good enough to be able to get a sense of what it would have looked like in antiquity.
Yeah. So the Temple of Bel has got a really interesting after Roman life, if I can call it that, where by the time archaeologists came by and had their adventures in antiquity, it was still an active site with an active settlement there, living within the walls of the temple. And from what I could find of the old photos from that time, it was heavily populated, well laid and constructed on top of each other, isn't it? Can you tell me about what you know about the settlement at that time and what the French in particular had planned for it?
So what happened at Palmyra in its post-Roman and even post-early Islamic phase is that the main city, sort of urban area, it drained out really of inhabitants. And most of what happens is a village builds up around the Bel complex itself. And the Keller, of course, was central to that. But as I say, it's a fairly large complex. So the old photos, the pre-French photos, show this quite vibrant type of village with houses and streets that occupy the entire Bel complex. And that seems to be going on quite early. We get some sense of that happening even from as far back as 9th, 10th centuries AD, CE. The French get the mandate over Syria and Lebanon as a consequence of the Sykes-Picot arrangement after the First World War. And when they take control of Syria, so they're doing it in Palmyra, they're doing it in other areas, they cleared out a lot of these types of arrangements. And so Crac de Chevalier, the very significant Crusader fortification, which is right over in the western part of the country, similarly was a village, and all the people living in it were cleared out and put into this sort of fairly not very nice sort of little concrete village down the hill. The same thing happened here in the Bell Complex, and this is in the 1920s and 30s. And these residences, so that the housing and all of the things that went with it, were all pulled down. And essentially the whole area, the French were trying to take it back to, well, their conception of it, really, in the Roman period. In many senses, it's a great pity that that happened, because it removed a very interesting, or mostly removed, a very interesting history of that structure. And in fact, it's one of the reasons that it survived so well, was because people were living around it and caring for it and using it. The other thing about the Bell Temple and the complex itself is that there are times that it appears that it was used as a fortification. We get evidence for that in other parts of this area, that old structures, large structures like this, could become used quite effectively as fortifications. And the most famous of those is the theater at Bosra in southern Syria. And one of the reasons that theater survives so well, it's almost perfectly preserved, is because in the Mamluk period, it was turned into a fort. I think what happened with the French, again, it was this sort of the West trying to recreate their own sense of what this place was. And unfortunately, in that process, got rid of a lot of very important, more recent history.
It didn't just get rid of history, it moved, it dislocated a whole population of people.
Exactly, it's a really important point, yeah.
And chuffed them off down the hill and installed them in what is still the local village,
That's
I assume.
Right. The Tadmor,
and
yeah.
What I can't get past about all of it is just the amount of effort and expense that it would have taken to do this, and they still thought that it was a worthwhile thing to do.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that the Jordanians did that in Petra relatively recently. So built a town that was designed for people who were living in the Petra National Park, who were living in the tombs. Not unusual for people still to be living in the tombs at Petra into the 70s and even into the 80s. And I think for the Jordanians, to a certain extent, they had some pressure put on them to do that, you know. And it does really, as you say, in relation here to the conversation about the Bell Complex, it dislocates a whole local tradition and moves it into something that has no real history to it, really. Yeah.
So what does that do to the archaeology to inform your history of an area when what you've got has been stripped back to just the Roman context and the Roman history of it being something that had been really in operation for just a few hundred years? It was the Temple of Bel, and then after that the location was something else for so much longer. So it kind of changes and informs how you interpret a site, doesn't it?
Well, it certainly does. Imagine doing it to London. Imagine if you strip back everything from London back to what remains of the Roman period. Imagine if you did it in Rome itself. What would you have left in Rome? You know, and I think that the way that later cultures incorporate the earlier architectural remains and all the other types of remains that you have is a really interesting thing. And it's one of the reasons I emphasized a little earlier, this idea of a destruction of Palmyra under Aurelian, and then it kind of just becomes a bit of a nothing. I'm really glad to see that that's being rewritten, because it's certainly not been the case at all. And it's become more and more a feature of the work that's being done at Palmyra. The only problem is that then people haven't had anywhere near as much to go by in doing that because of what, and not just the French. I mean, you've got the French authorities, but then you've got all the things that happen in the process of archaeology. You know, archaeology, there's this process still referred to as cleaning. You're cleaning everything out to get back down to these particular layers that you're really focused on. In the process, you know, you can be getting rid of a lot of really important historical information from later period.
So the 2015 invasion of ISIL to the area had a noticeable and a tragic impact, in particular on the Temple of Bel. That seems to have been the primary target that they took umbrage with. So can you tell me what happened to the temple and the state that it's in now?
So the Temple of Bel, like the Temple of Baal Shemin, and like the Tower Tombs especially, was particularly vulnerable to explosion. So they packed explosives into it, and because it's an enclosed area, the explosives have more of an impact. The shock of the explosive going off has more of an impact. And so it had the effect, the Temple of Bel, of effectively really of obliterating it. So the idea that you could take what's left and reconstruct is probably impossible. Fortunately, the temple was so thoroughly published in an extraordinary publication that finally came out in the 1970s, but had been worked on for 50 years by the French, means that if you wanted to reconstruct the Temple of Bel, you could do it every stone, because everything was published in extremely good detail. The targeting of Temple of Bel seems to have been, at least in part, because of the interest that ISIL knew that non-Islamic populations had in it, this term, the West more broadly, that they knew it would become a media hit. The Temple of Baal Shemin explosion, they filmed and put up on social media deliberately so it would be seen around the world. The messages have been very much aimed as well from ISIL at local Islamic populations and at Islamic populations in other parts of the Islamic world. So this obsession sometimes that we have in the West that everything's aimed at us couldn't be further from the truth. These were messages that were directed very much at other Muslim populations. And it's important, you know, for us to be mindful of that.
And the most that's standing now of the temple seems to be the main archway doorway.
Not even the doorway to the keller itself, but a proper lion, which was sort of a broader part of the complex, survived because the French had reconstructed using concrete.
Oh, okay.
And because it sat out from the temple, it wasn't actually built into the keller itself, they couldn't knock it down. Mm. So it was concrete, and I think they even used reinforcement wire. That's a very much a feature of the temple to Dasharas at Petra.
Yeah.
It'd be very hard to blow up because of this reinforcement and concrete. So that's that last feature of it that you see. You know, you can see it in all the images that have come out, sort of standing there defiantly, as it were. And the reason it is because it's held up by concrete.
I read that there's currently efforts underway by a French team who seem to be quite involved in the history of this structure to go in and scan what is left and see what can be reconstructed, if anything. So it seems to be a serious effort is going to be underway. But at that point, it's a bit like Theseus's ship. What remains of the original temple and what is current concrete kind of thing.
Yeah, and I think that what's really important with respect to this in terms of a reconstruction of the Temple of Bel or what else is done at Palmyra with regard to reconstruction is that the Syrians themselves are at the center of that. And it's really important for that country and its future in terms of the way it reconstructs in some way that its people aren't left off to the side when these types of things are happening, and that essentially are we going to end up doing what the French did back in the 1920s. You know, that unfortunately, as horrific as it is, this activity of ISIL is now part of the history of that area. And it's a horrible thing to think that, but it's true.
Yeah.
If we think about it, an important part of the history of Jerusalem is the destruction that the Romans wreaked on that city. And we can lament that and we can criticize it. It was hideous. But it's a part of the history of it. We can think of it in terms of what happened to the bombing of cities like Dresden in the Second World War. Such shocking carnage. Hiroshima, all these things. But they are part of the what can be a very sad history of these areas. And it's the people themselves who are most affected by these who have to have the most say in what happens in the post period, in the reconstruction period. And there will need to be a lot of assistance from Russian, French, British, American, Australian archaeologists, architects, etc. There will need to be that, and there will need to be finance that comes to help with this. But I think it's a real tragedy if the Syrians themselves are shut out of this or sidelined in that process. I have a horrible feeling they will be. That's my own feeling on it, but I think it's another sad chapter if that's the case.
That was Dr. Peter Edwell, a senior lecturer in the Department of History and Archaeology at Macquarie University, and you have been listening to When in Rome. If you like this podcast, please subscribe or leave a review. You can like When in Rome on the Emperors of Rome Facebook page, and you can follow both myself and Peter on Twitter. Peter is at Peter Edwell, I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast.
When in Rome is a publicly funded podcast, and I'd like to give a sincere thanks to all of those who have supported it. The imperator for this episode is Catherine Weber of Perth, Australia. And our triumvirs, as always, are Ken Acousti, Dean Pavitt, and Lorenzo Marasco. Ave to you. Also a shout out to Ollie Julian, the composer of the music that you're listening to in this podcast. It was the theme tune to the ITV show Plebs from Rise Comedy. That's it today for When in Rome. So until the next episode, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.